Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. I'm a public health physician and medical officer of health and clinical director of our local public health service, which I guess is equivalent to our local health department here. We have a staff of around 120, approximately half working in health protection and the other half working in health promotion. And I have a team of seven specialists, two of whom actually are in the room, and if you ask any really curly questions, I might have to turn to them. I don't have any relationships to disclose except with my city of Christchurch. This is Christchurch. It's a city of some 350,000 people. In the background there you can see the Southern Alps. Rise to 12,000 feet, so it's a significant mountain range. And we live on alluvial plains, which have essentially washed down from those mountains over the years. So Christchurch is a very flat city, but the alluvial plains butt up to the hill that this photograph is taken from. It's an extinct volcano, which I live on. This photograph was taken from pretty close to my boy's school on the 22nd of February last year, and the cloud that you can see in the centre there is not a cloud, it's dust rising from buildings falling in the centre of our city. So this was a terrible day, and no one who saw that could help but think that there were people in that cloud who they knew who were in trouble. And I do want to start by acknowledging the hurt of that day, but also by acknowledging the resilience of the people of Christchurch and the tremendous support that we've had since then from around our country and from around the world. My presentation is not an academic presentation. I'd like to share the experiences that we've had and to reflect a little bit on what we've learnt. I'll start by talking a little bit about the opportunities and the challenges for a public health service in this type of event. I'll talk a little bit about the first major earthquake that we experienced, which was back in September 2010, and then spend a bit more time talking about the February 2011 earthquakes. I'll talk then a little bit about recovery and how we've approached indicators of success of recovery, and finish with some reflections on our experience. So the opportunities for us at this stage in public health are, I think we can say that we had an effective acute response to our earthquakes. Our service worked well, we had good support, we dealt with the acute issues. And at the same time, public health issues were prominent in our community's minds in a way that they often aren't. So all of a sudden people got that drinking water was important, they got the fact that they needed safe sewage disposal, they got the fact that that actually it was important for people in the community to make connections with each other and look after each other. I guess, you know, that we talk about health determinants. This has been a time when actually people in our community understand health determinants in a way that they usually don't. And what we and our community realise is actually that public health people have a lot to offer around, the things that are important to people living healthy lives. So there is a great range of kind of new and renewed opportunities for public health dealing with this sort of disaster. At the same time, it's very difficult to work in this sort of context. This is our office building, which was unusable after the February earthquakes, and has now been demolished. It's now a flat site. I've been back into this building once. We had 2 hours when we could go in with engineers, with a small team to recover essentials. But essentially, we've been displaced from that building. We moved after both earthquakes to the basement of Christchurch Women's Hospital, which is a very secure building and did give us a place to work from. But we were working without files or our usual equipment. Most of our staff were spread out around the city and many were working from home. Christchurch is generally a pretty easy place to get around, but post-earthquake it's been very difficult. The roads have been damaged and traffic flows very slowly. And we did lose some staff. We had some people who, for various reasons couldn't work or who moved away from town. And those of us who were working were obviously having to deal with a whole lot of other stuff apart from their work challenges. So we had people working in a challenging environment at the same time as we had an incredibly rapid pace of change in our community. So we usually keep ourselves busy, but post earthquake everything was new and everything was urgent, and so we're faced with these wonderful opportunities to build a healthier city at the same time as working in some of the most difficult conditions that we'd ever worked in. So going back to September the 4th, 2010, at 4:30 in the morning, most of us were woken by a magnitude 7.1 earthquake. I've just put up a couple of kind of convenient other earthquakes to compare the size, but 7.1 is a big earthquake. I think I understand it's a similar size to the earthquake that San Francisco experienced in 89, not as big as the 1906 earthquake. But when you compare it with some of the kind of better known, more recent earthquakes, one of the things that we were very grateful for in September was that we didn't have any deaths. We were fortunate in that our buildings held up pretty well, and the time of day that it occurred at meant that most people were home in bed. So where there was kind of public building damage, it didn't mostly cause trauma. What we did discover, some of us had read about liquefaction, but we discovered it for real. Because we live on alluvial plains, essentially we live on closely packed shingle and silt with water, layers of water underneath. And during an earthquake, our September earthquake lasted 45 seconds, and that sort of substrate essentially acts like a liquid during that time of shaking. And so we had extensive silt erupting across the city. We had parts of our ground just collapsed, and water and flooding extensively across the city. So that's very inconvenient, but of course it's also quite a challenge for public health, because lots of the public health infrastructure is in that ground, which and it's not designed to take shaking or movement. And so there was that left many of our houses and buildings without water supply, sewage disposal, and mostly without power. We discovered that masonry buildings essentially are held together by gravity, and during an earthquake, gravity just doesn't do the trick. So this was one of the more dramatic photos from our September earthquake, but it was a reminder really that that building codes are important, and that we were very fortunate that we have had good building codes in place for a number of decades, and it was really the older brick buildings that suffered the sort of damage, not the majority of our buildings. This is a quick list of the public health issues that we dealt with post-September earthquakes. We had broken pipes and water erupting through the ground, so there was extensive local contamination of sewage and sewage flowing into our waterways. There was concern about contamination of water supplies, but fortunately the water reticulation held up very well. We did some 1,400 water tests over the first 3 or 4 days, and they all came back clear. Obviously there's concerns around food safety and premises without power. We were concerned about disease outbreaks, but they did not occur in September. September is the end of our winter, beginning of our springtime, so we had quite cold conditions, and there were concerns about warmth and shelter. We set up welfare centres, but they weren't much used. Chemical spills weren't an issue at that time, and I guess we were shaken as a community, one of the things that we learned is this sort of disaster is not fair. Many of us could return fairly quickly to our ordinary lives, whereas some people had homes that needed demolished and livelihoods which weren't going to continue. So the social issues were very much at the front of our minds in terms of a public health response. But we were fortunate in that while we had an acute response that lasted a couple of weeks, by the end of 2 weeks the emergency had been declared over. We stood down our emergency operations centre. We in many ways could return to business as normal. We did have these ongoing recovery issues. Sewage contamination, it was clear even at that point that the sewage system was going to take months, if not years, to repair. that we did need to go into looking at community recovery, looking at how to help people manage their response to this event. There would be buildings and infrastructure to restore. There was also opportunities in terms of, well, how do you rebuild things in a way that's better for public health? And one of the themes that we were clear we needed to pay attention to from a public health point of view was making sure that as most people returned back to business as usual, that we didn't leave our disadvantaged people even more disadvantaged. But we also realised that recovery is something that we'd never practised in an emergency. You know, you have your one-day emergency response exercise. You kind of leave recovery at the end of it. And so, with the size of that first event, actually many agencies wanted to return to business as usual. Businesses wanted to get back to running their businesses. People wanted to kind of make this a small event and not pay too much. They wanted it to be over. They didn't want to be in recovery mode. And that was a real danger, I think, in terms of, you know, this sort of event increasing disparities in the community. And so we did spend a bit of time looking at the recovery literature, which actually is more helpful at telling you what not to do than what to do. But one of the themes that was really important there is actually, you know, if you want to help people recover, one of the important things to do is to deal with the practical issues so that people can get on with their lives and don't have to worry about their drains or sewage. Well, five months down the track, on the 22nd of February, when we thought, you know, the aftershocks had diminished, we'd had some 4,000 aftershocks by then, we felt we were kind of getting through things, we had this very different event. It was a smaller earthquake, but it was closer to the city and much, much more damaging. So this was a terrible day. I won't run through those numbers, but really, you know, that afternoon we had a broken city and a very, very different type of public health response. And I guess, you know, one of the things that was very interesting for us was that actually, as a public health unit, we knew what to do. We had kind of been through a whole bunch of thinking and work around an earthquake response, and so we very quickly moved back into emergency response mode. But the local, regional, and national response that was happening around us was very different. It was clear early on that this wasn't something that we could cope with on our own, and we had a national civil defence emergency declared the next day. And obviously the big urban search and rescue operations happening immediately. Our central business district was cordoned off. We did this time have half a dozen welfare centres around town and sports stadiums, which we needed to pay attention to from a public health point of view. We had an immediate boil water notice and alternative water supplies because much of our water supply was interrupted. And we had, I think, 30,000 chemical toilets installed around the city fairly quickly because the sewage system was clearly going to be broken for a very long time. This is our office, and as I said, you know, the damage here was quite extensive, and so we had to move our operations to a more secure environment, and haven't been back to this building since. This is our central business district. It's small by North American standards. Most of those tall buildings have been or will be demolished. There's still probably a fifth of that area that you can see in that photograph is still cordoned off, and there's still extensive demolition happening. That sort of damage meant actually, most of the agencies who were needing to respond to this earthquake had their headquarters knocked out, so, you know, that was a challenge in itself. And most of the trauma actually happened in this area as well, due to tall building damage or damage to older commercial buildings in this part of town. uh, As a public health service, we don't provide drinking water, but we have a role in audit and support of drinking water quality. So we moved very quickly into supporting the local authority to do drinking water testing. We have an artesian water supply. The water comes down from the mountain and spends around 30 years underground and comes up in 30-odd springs around town. And so it's a lovely water supply. It's mineral water. But we had a damaged pipework. And this time when we got out and did our water testing, what that showed is actually quite extensive contamination of the drinking water supply. These are positive E. coli tests around town. And so we reasonably quickly had to recommend introduction of chlorination and wait until the free available chlorine levels were adequate before we could remove our boil water notices. So as a public health service, this was a very large part of our work over the first few weeks, managing and advising on drinking water quality for the community. There were recreational water issues at the same time, for months and months after that earthquake, we had raw sewage discharging into our waterways because when the pipes break, that's kind of the default place that the sewage flows to. This earthquake happened in February, so that's at the end of our summer. People wanted to be using those waterways, but really couldn't. We have a type of fish called whitebait, a little white baby fish that swims in the rivers and that people net for. We had to do quite a lot of work persuading people not to net for those fish. Our boil water notice was in place for a couple of months, and we were very pleased to find when we did a telephone survey at 6 weeks that people had responded very well to this earthquake. This telephone survey showed that around 80% of people were still boiling their water at 6 weeks. We were also fortunate that we'd done a lot of work around hand hygiene in the preceding couple of years around pandemic response. And so people were familiar with those messages around hand hygiene. And we certainly did a lot of work at a community level, just going out and fronting up to the community, really reinforcing those messages around the need to prevent infections. And we were very pleased that that we didn't have gastro outbreaks as part of this event. We'd been through a couple of years of heightened awareness around influenza, and one of the things we were very aware of is that as we went from February into our winter, that the risk factors for influenza were going to be very much greater in our community, with damaged housing, with people living in crowded conditions, and often without a heating source, and that it would be. There will be real challenges for people in getting good medical care. And we lost around 100 of our 600 hospital beds and around 600 residential care beds. So there was really a potential for a huge amount of stress on our health care system through that winter. So one of the decisions that we made as part of the District Health Board was to offer free influenza vaccination for all under 18s. And again, we were very pleased to find we didn't have any elevation in influenza rates through that year of 2011. Housing quality has been, it's always a public health issue, but it was one of the issues that's been really highlighted for us through these couple of years. Most houses in Christchurch have had some degree of damage, with around 25,000 severely damaged. It's been very difficult to measure the amount of displacement, but clearly many people are living in substandard housing, having lost wall cladding, having chimneys that fared very badly in the earthquake, so lots of people have lost their main heating source. And with displaced people, there were a number of people in overcrowded conditions. So winter heating was quite a focus, and one of the part of our public health response was to assist with identifying vulnerable households and to push for them to be prioritised as part of any heating initiatives. We have had installation of heat pumps into quite a number of homes. That's meant those homes have been able to stay warm, but it has been a challenge in terms of the potential for power cuts. Houses which previously had wood as a source of heating are now dependent on electricity. Well, I've had the 5-minute warning, so I'm going to skip a couple of slides. In terms of community response, in the healthcare system, we've braced ourselves for an influx of people who could no longer manage at home, who'd been knocked around by the earthquake, who needed residential care. In fact, what happened was that people looked after each other very well in the earthquake, and that didn't happen. We realised very quickly that that connectedness and encouraging people to look after needed to be an important part of our public health response. And the messages that we had around people's reaction to this event were really about normalising, avoiding a label of post-traumatic stress disorder, which you don't qualify for 3 months after the event anyway, and really trying to give people mechanisms and help for supporting each other through these events. I'm just going to talk very quickly about some components of our public health response. Information is a real challenge in this sort of event. One of our tools was we quickly produced a web-based situation report that we could use to keep ourselves updated, but also as a tool for reporting up to other agencies and other parts of our health system. And so that could be updated live, but was also the thing that we sent off to other agencies. Surveillance was quite a challenge because in this sort of event, your usual information sources don't work the same way. And after some debate, we opted for a low-tech approach. We decided that we didn't need fancy systems for the welfare centres. We needed to just have our staff fronting up each day, talking to people and finding out what the issues were and coming back to us. We did ask GPs to report on any increases in gastroenteritis, but it was a qualitative report. No, we didn't try and collect numbers. We did keep tabs on fecal samples, but all of those kind of usual healthcare use measures are very difficult to interpret when healthcare use has been so disrupted by the event. We did start our influenza-like illness surveillance early, and after several weeks we did also do a computer-assisted telephone survey just to get a feel for what was going on at a community level. Oh, this was just a reminder that I'm smiling because under our Health Act, a Medical Officer of Health has quite extensive legislative powers, so this event triggered powers to do all sorts of things that I'd never had the power to do before. In fact, they were little used. We did have quite some debate and issued a declaration around school closure, and we also declared the river unsanitary, which was the legal means we had to stop people fishing for white bait, which potentially could get into the commercial food supply. And the New Zealand Food Safety Authority did use legislative powers around keeping food premises shut as well. We have an incident management system called Coordinated Incident Management System. It's very similar to the systems that your fire services use here. That was very valuable in terms of not command and control, but in terms of being really clear about the need for good communications flow and the need for people to step out of business as usual into a response model, but also very effective for us in terms of being clear where we fitted into a bigger health system response and who we needed to be reporting up to. Of course, working with local authorities was a key part for us, and I guess one of the lessons for us was that having existing good relationships with the people you need to work with in an emergency is really important. And we were in some ways fortunate to have worked through a pandemic and a smaller earthquake with these people before the big one hit. I'm going to skip through a couple. We, after the earthquake, you know, all of the agencies were keen to get out and connect with the community. One of the things we did is make sure that we had a medical officer of health fronting up to all the community briefings. So that was a big commitment in terms of time from our team, but it was important in terms of really reinforcing public health messages. And in terms of our recovery from the earthquake, that's the real challenge. I mean, what we did in, as an acute response, we're very pleased with. But we have a community that will be in recovery mode for years and years. And you know, it was very quickly clear to us that recovery from the earthquake needed to be the main focus for our public health service. In terms of our service, there were challenges for us in reconfiguring at the time that we were displaced and working from home. We were very grateful to have support from public health services outside of our region, and I guess one of the opportunities for us was realising actually that you can work together across boundaries much better than you think that you can, and that's been a spur for us in looking at greater regional work into the future with our neighbours. There's been lots of talk at this meeting about wider health determinants, and you know, the fact that public health actually doesn't own the agencies that implement many wider health determinants. This is one of the tools that we're very proud of. After the September earthquake, some of our team started working on a recovery planning guide, which we made available and worked with other agencies on using in their planning. It's really just a thinking tool that encourages agencies to think about these components of health, and it's been formally adopted by a number of the other agencies in the community. So we really have kind of changed the dialogue around health determinants as part of that recovery. Community engagement obviously is a kind of a key to a successful recovery. People need to be involved in the decisions that affect their lives. But there are some real challenges and tensions in that as well. You know, this is a community that's under a huge amount of strain, and you know, while they may want to be involved, the reality of actually being consulted on recovery was a difficult one. There was certainly, you know, a keenness to participate, but also a fatigue that we needed to acknowledge. An interesting tension between, you know, the people who usually like to have a voice on community and, you know, public affairs issues, and some different community groups that have emerged post earthquake, really kind of highlighting some of the unspoken tensions for our community. We, you know, like many other agencies, we're interested in looking at, well, what will it mean for us to have a successful recovery? And again, we consulted the literature on success indicators. We spent quite some time ourselves looking at what data we could access, what health information we felt was important, what original research we could undertake or could get support to make happen. But where we finished up with is actually in doing monitoring success as a collaborative venture. Post-earthquake, we have a new government department, the Canterbury Earthquake Response Authority, an earthquake response minister. So we have a dedicated agency looking at earthquake recovery. And in the end, we figured, look, it doesn't make sense to have different sets of indicators for the different agencies around town. We really need to collaborate on this. So we have what's called the Canterbury Wellbeing Index, and that will be monitoring community recovery over the next, for 5 years post-earthquake. So I'll wrap up with some reflections, and these are my reflections after the first September earthquake. That in many ways we've been fortunate that we got off relatively lightly for a big earthquake, that we're fortunate that we have a resilient community. We have a lot of community resources to call on. Fortunate that we're prepared, that all those years of emergency response exercises did pay off. We were very grateful for engineers, for people who actually paid attention to us having good pipes under the ground and good strong buildings. SIMS was very useful, that coordinated incident management structure. And being, you know, acknowledging our role in public health as part of a wider health system response was very important in terms of both resourcing our response, but also you know, having a common voice and understanding of health issues. We said that we'd be better prepared the next time and recognised that recovery was going to be the real test for us. And these are my reflections, you know, post the 12,000 odd earthquakes we've had since September, that our city's never going to be the same again. But at the same time, we do now have an unprecedented opportunity to influence some of those really key health determinants. We have learnt that partnerships are central to success, and that partnerships are best if you build them early. And that, you know, and the challenges that we have faced and that we will continue to face for years in rebuilding our city, that public health actually has a lot to offer, because what we want is a healthy city, a place that's good for people to live in, and actually that's what our community wants as well. So that the tools that we have are very useful tools for our community in this recovery time. That's it from me. Thank you.
That was fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Williams. So what we'll do is, why don't we just take a couple of minutes here for questions directly for this presentation, and then I'm going to ask Dr. Stoder to come up, and then we can just sort of tag team for either presentation or either presenter. So questions for Dr. Williams in the back.
No, it's a good question. The Canterbury Wellbeing Index is owned by the Earthquake Recovery Authority, so it's a bundle of measures which have been created as part of the recovery. It does use some pre-existing measures, but there's also some new data collection that happens as part of that. My colleague Annabelle, who's sitting there in the middle, has had a lot of debates with the different agencies around using tools that we may be able to have external comparisons with, and that's been, you know, there are a whole lot of political challenges around negotiating what goes into a measure that in the end the Minister for Earthquake Recovery owns. So that's been a very interesting process, and what we've finished up with is that, you know, it's going to be a useful set of measures, but it is a compromise. But do you want to add anything to that, Annabelle? Mike.
Well, that was a terrific presentation. Thank you for that. There's a lot of interest in the U.S. about the concept of resiliency, which I think sometimes your whole talk was about, but you didn't use the next slide, the specific word in. And specifically, people are trying to say, what can we measure about communities now that will predict resilience in an event like this? And so if you could say, you know, what were some of the characteristics of Canterbury that you think led, that you could have measured beforehand, that you think led to a successful recovery as soon as possible?
Well, I'm not sure you can offer an academic answer to that, because we've certainly looked at, you know, how can we measure community resilience, and there's been quite a lot of research interest in that post-earthquake. You know, from our point of view, you know, well, what is it about that makes us feel our community is resilient? We have a kind of do-it-yourself attitude in New Zealand, and Canterbury is particularly like that. We do have we have kind of a local pride. We like to think that that we're in things together. Well, there's a kind of sense that Canterbury, you know, if you come from Canterbury, you have an affinity to the people around you. We do, I think, we tend to know the people around us. You know, maybe not so well, but you know, we tend to know at least some of our neighbours. And that was something that, you know, in our public health messaging, that was what we came back to. We said, you know, go and check on your neighbours, talk to your family, you know, build those connections, make sure that the people around you are okay. That was hugely important, I think. And I don't know how you measure that. But certainly there are ways of encouraging it, you know, and building it. You know, my colleague Lucy who is sitting down there in the middle. She's been involved in some of the wellbeing messaging that we're looking at as part of the recovery effort, and looking at some very practical ways of building up those community connections and people's own sense of being able to work their way through this. Lucy, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I know that traditional resilience grant after an emergency, which you know, if it goes well, there's a resilience grant. We've had some problems with that grant because we've had like two major events, and we've also had some other reasonably significant earthquakes that sent us back, and we don't know where that will come out. And we have the Prime Minister's scientific advisor advises that 2 years after the event, that's when resilience will be lowest and the adaptive buffer is completely gone. And so we're working very hard at the moment on community wellbeing campaign, probably based on that mental health promotion meta review that identified Give, Connect, you know, the five ways of wellbeing. And so we're working very hard with that, because exactly the things that Daniel said after the quake helped people. Now that we need to rebuild that now, and we've talked about Cantabrians thinking that they can do things themselves. I mean, I'm an adopted Cantabrian, I'm born in the UK, and I do believe that most New Zealanders genuinely believe they could build their own house if they just had enough. But in fact, one of the biggest problems now is insurance, and one of the problems with insurance is that people thought that insurance was a way of looking after yourself and your family. It was a resourceful thing. And actually, insurance is an international, globalised thing. And the reinsurers are not very happy with Canterbury. So actually, individuals are paying the price for that. So the sense of being a resilient individual is very challenged by that, actually being a pawn of a reinsurer in Munich, which is on my way. So it's a very interesting time. But we're confident.
I would have guessed that in addition to things that you said, Daniel, that things like partnerships and having these pre-existing relationships that you mentioned before are the kind of things that would predict resilience. Do you agree? Or I'm saying so. The question is not going for where you are, but from where we are. How would we know whether we're better prepared to respond to something like this?
Well, I guess, yeah, yes, interesting. I mean, you know, I've responded in terms of individual and community level resilience. In terms of organisational resilience, you know, I think I touched on, you know, the fact that our incident management structure nested inside a health system management structure. We are very fortunate, actually, even in New Zealand, in that, you know, we're in a district of the size where you can get together all the important health players in a room or on a teleconference, and you know, you can make decisions, you can coordinate things. And actually, you know, the same thing happened at a citywide emergency response level. You can get the players in the same room, and you know two-thirds of the people before you start. So I think that actually, you know, our size did count for us. Again, I don't know quite how you measure that, but in terms of organisational resilience, having those connections between the agencies certainly was very important.
Great. Just before we continue to go on, let me ask Mike to come on up if there are any questions for him as well. We're at 5:42 according to my iPhone, so I'm not sure how accurate that is, but that means that we are right. We have 18 minutes if we went to 6 o'clock. I did promise we're going to try to get done a little bit early, so I'd like to just go to 10 till. So that gives us about 8 minutes of Q&A right now. And I think there's a question here, and then just let us know who it's for.
Yeah, so you mentioned the need and the challenges of engaging the community in the during the recovery period, and I was wondering if there had been any kind of formal process or methods that you tried, and as you could describe a little bit about what you've done in terms of engaging the community.
Questions about community engagement.
So one of the slides that I skipped over was how our community responded, and you know, I think the first part of my answer to your question is, well, actually, you know, the community does that stuff, you know, so two examples of that were we're a university town, we have some 8,000 university students. One of our university students set up a Facebook page and organised students to go and help people who needed help. They were called the Student Army, and it was just fantastic. You know, it kind of touched everybody. You had these, you know, bunches of students descending on the hardest hit suburbs with their wheelbarrows and shovels and shovelling salt out of old ladies' front gardens. So, you know, there was a whole kind of movement at a community level for people within the city to look after each other. And we also had, they were called the Farmy Army, we had farmers coming in from outside of the city with their trucks just loaded up with food and whatever other supplies. We had a woman who drove from Wellington, she drove all night essentially, she took the whole weekend, she filled up her van with you know, provisions and supplies, drove to Christchurch, kind of delivered them off and kind of hit it. You know, actually there was a very strong sense that the community was looking after each other. So in terms of community engagement, particularly early on, that was a very strong sense. In terms of our health response, I guess I've mentioned the sort of the messaging and the kind of fronting up to the community, being there in person, not just kind of texting or, you know, putting out newsletters, but being there to answer questions and to talk to people if that was what they wanted. And even though that actually only reached a small proportion of the city, everyone knew that they had that kind of access. If they wanted to front up and ask people questions, then they could. I guess, you know, engagement is a much bigger challenge in recovery. You know, it's a kind of a whole body of work looking at, well, what are the things that you can do to keep the community feeling like they have a sense of coming together and a sense of ownership of the recovery issues. We did have a very, a very successful consultation process around the Central City Rebuild, where we, you know, our City Council asked the community what they wanted, and there was an opportunity for people to email in, respond via a website. They kind of ran seminars over weekends, so people did get quite a sense that they could participate in some of the thinking around recovery planning. I think we're at the stage now where, like with the insurance, actually, you know, kind of we're hitting the hard stuff. There are some difficult decisions being made, which are being made at, you know, not at a community level.
Great. You know, I did want to make a quick comment. Some of the folks in this room were in a previous session on crisis standards of care. I was on a panel for Institute of Medicine really describing some of the challenges of a no-notice event or slow, sort of slowly evolving event. And it's interesting that both of these presenters actually have described just that, an earthquake and a pandemic, although, you know, certainly H1N1, as we know, was not as serious as we had all originally thought it was going to be. What's really fascinating is that we've actually worked from the IOM to look at public engagement. And Barbara Fain, who just asked that question, actually was our IOM consultant on really looking at public engagement and actually trying to move forward public engagement activities. So my question actually is about In New Zealand, did you see any differences in sort of the ability for a community to sort of get it? For, let's say, a Christ Church that actually has gone through multiple earthquakes, whereas, although it's a relatively small island, but are there other parts of the country that may not have been as impacted, and so the public maybe not being as involved in being in the immediate aftermath of a disaster response, and some differences in the engagement or level of engagement of the public? Have you noted any differences, or is that kind of beyond spectrum of what you've all looked at?
You don't have to repeat the question.
I'm not sure how much everyone knows about New Zealand. So we have 4 million people. Christchurch is in the South Island. We have around 1 million people in the South Island. So most people in New Zealand weren't materially affected by this earthquake. Quite a lot of people felt it. So I guess, you know, we're small enough that the whole country felt that it affected them. You know, our national radio ran very little else apart from earthquake stories for weeks afterwards. There was a great sense of support from around the country. In terms of, people experiencing or responding to that, I can't really comment on that. I mean, I think everywhere around New Zealand would respond in different ways, but there'd be some common themes there. I think one of the things that has been that's felt quite difficult living in Christchurch 2 years after the event is the rest of the country has moved on in many ways. This is our central city, but actually, you know, Auckland and Wellington are carrying on with largely business as usual. And so it can be quite difficult to feel as though, you know, our disruptive lives really kind of don't, well, that just doesn't make sense to people who don't experience this every day. And I guess, I'm not sure if I quite answered your question, actually, in terms of, you know, the different ways that people would respond, but it's certainly, recovery, you know, really puts quite a different lens on this sort of event. And for the people who are in the middle of it, it's a very different experience from seeing things on your TV screen, even if you feel connected to them early on.
Okay, this will be our final question. So,
well, this has been going through. I was thinking a lot about Haiti and about hurricanes now, and a lot of what happens is people get displaced, right? Their homes get destroyed. And I wondered how many people got displaced on that, but you seem to be living in a earthquake vulnerable area, although I think that predicting earthquakes is a lot harder than predicting hurricanes. I mean, we seem to know when the next storm is coming up, we can spot it, but exactly tracking it, so people do have a little bit more warning that it's going to happen. You know, I mean, what I'm worried about down there is you don't have enough time to rebuild before the next one hits. I mean, that's kind of entering into your long-term planning.
New Zealand's exists because two tectonic plates kind of rub up against each other, and that's why we've got an alpine, you know, why we've got Alps. And we're expecting large earthquakes along that alpine fault. It's 80, 100 miles away from us. Our earthquakes occurred on a previously unknown fault, so they really did come out of the blue. And, although they're smaller than what we might expect from a big alpine fault rupture, because they were so close, they were very damaging. Of course, we don't know when the next one's going to be. I guess, you know, there are some silver linings to our clouds, and one of the silver linings for us is that we will finish up living in a very strong city. You know, the vulnerable buildings will be gone. Buildings will be rebuilt strong, and so, you know, I'm confident that my children will grow up in a city where they're at much lower risk of, you know, being killed in an earthquake from a building than people might in other parts of New Zealand even. So, and, you know, again, even at the moment, even before we've rebuilt, you know, there's been a huge amount of work going into building assessment, buildings that we previously would have been in quite happily, I think, you know, no longer being occupied because of that sort of heightened awareness around earthquake risk. So, you know, the risk of trauma actually feels like kind of one of the smaller risks that we're facing in terms of community health.
If I could just add one thing that struck me about your presentation is that the importance of the work you had done to prepare for pandemics, and the sense that it's just preparedness in general that makes a difference, and being able to say when the earthquake is going to come is really, I mean, it would be nice to be able to do it, but they really had to prepare for the recovery, and they did a good job of that because they had been working on pandemics. And I think that kind of generalized preparedness, that's an important lesson to me that comes out of this.
So thank you for that last comment. I really want to thank everybody for being here. I think there are reflections and insights from H1N1 and really the sort of the multi-tiered approach that many health departments across the country used and as was presented in the first presentation that I think all of us really need to be thinking about in a pandemic situation, and certainly this last presentation about a no-notice event as an earthquake and some of the global lessons that we can learn from these kinds of disasters. Again, thank you, everybody. Thank our presenters. They were phenomenal, both of them. And remember, ICEHS.